Science, Diane. On my mind, the National Institutes of Health will see a leadership change at the end of the year. Dr. Francis Collins announced he'll step down as head of the nation's medical research agency after 12 years, having held the post under Presidents Obama, Trump, and Biden. Dr. Collins is an acclaimed geneticist. He helped discover the gene that causes cystic fibrosis and led the team that mapped the human genome. Dr. Collins joined me earlier this week, just after news broke of Colin Powell's death due to complications from the coronavirus. Dr. Collins and I talked about the NIH successes and continued challenges in the fight against COVID-19, as well as the intersection between his Christian faith and scientific research. Dr. Collins, after 12 years as director of the NIH, you have decided to step down at the end of the year. I'm going to personally miss you so much, but please tell me why you've made that decision.
Well, I'm going to miss all of the things that have been part of this amazing experience over these 12 years, Diane. And talking with you has always been a big part of that, too. So I'm glad we get to do that again today. It was not like I just had a bad day and said, okay, that's it, I'm out of here. This was something I thought about, wrestled with over many months. You know, I thought I was leaving the role of NIH director 5 years ago because NIH directors have virtually always turned over when the presidency turned over. And so when Obama's second term ended, I had everything all planned to head back into my lab and think about other things to do. And then there was an effort on the part of a number of members of the Congress to convince the new president, Donald Trump, to keep me on, which ultimately he did. And I was glad to have the chance to maintain some continuity in research and so stayed with that effort. And then, of course, things got complicated with COVID when Joe Biden was elected. We were in the middle of some of the worst parts of COVID-19. Vaccines hadn't quite arrived yet. The peak of terrible experiences of hospitalizations and deaths was upon us. And so when Biden asked me to stay for a while, I said, of course. But I did say at the time, I'm probably kind of reaching my shelf life here as an NIH director, and I'll be glad to be part of your administration for a while, but I don't think I'm signing on for 4 more years. So I've struggled with this. I did a personal retreat just myself out in Loudoun County. I got an Airbnb, which turned out to be a loft above a horse barn, which was very, you know, scenic, except the horses made a lot of noise in the middle of the night, which was not very restful, and had the chance to really spend a couple of days thinking, mapping out pros and cons, praying about it, because that's what I do, and ultimately deciding, you know, this is a good time to plan a departure for some time by the end of the year. There's a good reason for that, by the way, practically, because if I'm not staying for the whole 4 years, I need to give the president a chance to identify a new director, to nominate that person, and to get them through Senate confirmation, because that's required for this position. And we all know that doesn't happen so quickly. And especially it doesn't happen very quickly if it's late in the term, and then it doesn't happen at all. So to be sure that the door is wide open here for the next amazing NIH director to step in, it's good not to wait much longer. So all of that sort of played out, and here we are, October 5th, making this announcement that I'm planning to step down by the end of the year. And I must say, goodness, such an outpouring of wonderful messages from hundreds of people, many of whom I don't even know. I felt like, gosh, is this what it's like to be able to watch your own funeral? All of these eulogies from people who clearly wanted to tell me something. It was very heartwarming. So I've been so fortunate to have this chance to do this. And I'm not complaining, but I will tell you, it's been a little bittersweet, and I have had some serious mixed emotions over the course of the last couple of weeks contemplating this change.
I can surely understand that, as well as the outpouring of affection, admiration, respect that you have received once you made that announcement. You mentioned prayer. Tell me about your religious life and what it means to you.
Well, it's a very important part of who I am. I became a believer in my 20s. I did not grow up that way. I was, by the time I was in graduate school studying quantum mechanics, I was an atheist. Medical school changed me by encountering issues of life and death every day up close, and realizing there were some pretty profound questions about the meaning of life and why is there something instead of nothing, and how are we supposed to live our lives, and what happens after you die, that science wasn't really able to provide much in the way of answers, and decided I needed to explore that more deeply. I was very fortunate to encounter the writings of people who had thought through those issues, particularly C.S. Lewis, and also to meet some other scientists who were people of faith, and to find out that that was something that was intellectually compatible, satisfying even, and that there was no reason to imagine that you had to pick one or the other worldview. You could, in fact, be a person of science and a person of faith. And somewhat to my surprise, this is about a 2-year journey, ended up becoming converted to Christianity. And that's been a very fundamental part of who I am ever since. And so I try to bring that perspective, not always successfully, into everything that I am faced with. And I spend a little time every morning, usually at 5 a.m., trying to get regrounded in my spiritual beliefs and my hopes through prayer to get guidance when I don't know what else to do.
Are you a member of a particular religious denomination?
You know, I've never really understood all these different Christian denominations, maybe because I didn't grow up in one. So yes, I have been at times a Methodist. I have been a Baptist, not a Southern Baptist, an American Baptist. I've been a Presbyterian, which is sort of what I am right now. And I honestly can't quite see the difference. So I wish sometimes the Christians would figure out what they have in common and spend a little less time worrying about what they don't have in common.
However, it is the religious fundamentalists who have been, as a group, so opposed to the COVID vaccine. How do you see that? How do you explain that?
You know, Diane, that is a source of great puzzlement, and it's very disheartening to see how we got to this place. Christians, after all, in the course of all these centuries, have often been known for being the most generous responders to crisis. When there was a plague and everybody else ran for the hills, Christians tended to run towards the problem and try to help out their neighbors and take care of the sick and the dying. Boy, this seems somehow all turned upside down here. And for me, as a person who also sees faith and science as things that go hand in hand, to have such confusion in many parts of the church about what to believe about things like masks and vaccines is really troubling. I think right now the problem is made so much worse by the polarization of everything in our country, by the fact that people are taking sides and sticking to their tribal alliances, and that politics has infected everything, including the church. And so a lot of what I hear from people in the church who are skeptical or even downright objecting loudly to vaccines, when you ask the reasons why, they often end up being more related to politics than they are to science. This is a terrible, unfortunate mixing. Public health and politics don't belong together. And certainly public health, politics, and religion don't belong together, and yet they're all mixed up right now. And I guess I have felt some calling here as a person of faith and a scientist to try to reach out to those communities and help people work this through and see if you were praying for deliverance from COVID-19 and these vaccines came along and they were incredibly safe and effective. Boy, isn't that a great answer to prayer as opposed to something to be suspicious about? I've done podcasts with Rick Warren, with Tim Keller, with Walter Kim, with Franklin Graham, and I don't know if it did any good or not, because people are so dug in at this point. It's not just that we are polarized. We're concrete in terms of our polarization. We get ossified into these perspectives, and it's very hard to get people to reopen their mind to considering some other view. So yeah, of the many heartaches of the last 22 months, which mostly, I guess, includes the more than 700,000 people who have died, at least 100,000 of whom didn't need to if they had actually taken advantage of vaccines. The way the church has played out is just one more really sad, heartbreaking part of this.
And another sad and heartbreaking part is that we have just learned of the death of Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, former head of the Joint Chiefs, Medal of Honor winner. And his family says that he died of COVID and had been fully vaccinated. I wonder what your thoughts are about that first. Given that he was fully vaccinated, is his death going to further undermine belief in the vaccine as something that will prevent one from dying from the virus? Or is it going to spur others to get the vaccine?
Well, I've just heard also about the death of somebody I've so admired, Colin Powell, and I'm really devastated to hear this. I was with him 5 weeks ago, Diane. There was a special event at the Kennedy Center on September 10th. It was basically a recognition of 20 years of 9/11. Colin Powell spoke about that day of 9/11. And then I was supposed to speak about how the frontline workers against COVID have some similarities there in terms of the frontline responses to 9/11 in New York and at the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. And yes, I am deeply troubled that despite his fully vaccinated state, he was one of those who got a breakthrough infection, and not just a mild case, but it took his life. Now, is that unprecedented? Not unprecedented, but extremely uncommon. And I worry, as you've just articulated, whether some people will look at this and go, well, there you see, the vaccines don't do any good for anybody. That would be a huge mistake in terms of actually looking at the data. CDC just put up another website on Friday with the data showing exactly what does happen in terms of hospitalizations and deaths, comparing unvaccinated people to fully vaccinated people. And of course, the greatest risk are older people. And the difference is 11-fold. You're 11-fold more likely to die of COVID-19 if you're unvaccinated than if you're fully vaccinated. But that doesn't say it's not possible to also end up dying in a vaccinated person, as has happened in this case. So yeah, anybody who tries to take a single example and say, well, that proves the answer, is walking away from data that's much more quantitative than that. So I would also say that what we are seeing, and the reason for all of the noise and excitement about boosters right now, is exactly this, that we do know that people who are fully vaccinated, especially if they're over 65, begin to have a waning of the protection after 6 months or more. And that's why people in that circumstance, which would include Colin Powell if he was still alive, are recommended to get a booster. So it's tragic indeed that that didn't come along quite quickly enough to give General Powell the boost in immunity that might have saved him. Again, I certainly hope that people who hear about this Grieve about him, but do not take this as a reason, if you're not vaccinated yet, to keep delaying. Again, your chance of dying of this disease is 11-fold higher without that vaccination. So please, people, if you're listening and you're one of those that's been holding out, this would be a great moment to look at the data, check it out, talk to your doctor, talk to your pastor, see what the other people that you trust would say. And I'm pretty sure they will say, oh, hurry up, go roll up your sleeve. There's still time.
Where are we right now with this virus and with the vaccine? We've heard so many people say, oh, I'm tired of all this restriction. I mean, you've seen what's happened in Texas. The governor is saying nobody has to be masked. I mean, what are your thoughts? Where are we now?
Well, I get it that people are tired. I'm tired of it too, but the virus is not tired of us. And every opportunity we provide this virus to sicken and take the lives of people, it's going to do it. We just can't afford to let up our guard. We're really in a battle here. I'm sure people were tired in the middle of World War II after 22 months, but they didn't have the chance to just basically say, okay, we're done. You got to keep going until you've actually won the victory. And we're not there yet with COVID-19. We still have work to do, and that's up to all of us. We're all in this battle together, because every unvaccinated person who gets sick still is likely to infect two or three or five others, and you don't end a pandemic that way. And anybody who tries to say, well, it's just my decision and nobody else matters, that's not the way it works. If your decision is not to protect yourself, then you're putting other people around you, your family, your neighbors, your community, especially those vulnerable people that can't get immunity from the vaccine, the people with cancer or the kids under 12, you're putting them at risk. If you really believe in loving your neighbors, here's a chance to live that out. Even if you're not crazy about the idea about needles, this is the moment where you can do something to help people. Where we are right now, Diane, I mean, we are looking at a circumstance where, thank God, this terrible fourth wave is waning a bit. We no longer see cases going up every day. They're coming down. I wish they were coming down faster. We still have maybe 80,000 new cases every single day. We have 60,000 people in the hospital, and the average age under 50 now. This is not just a disease of the elderly. And we're losing the lives of over 1,000 people every day. Imagine that we had three or four jumbo jets crashing every day. Do you think people would just stop paying attention? But we've sort of stopped paying attention because we're so numb, so used to it. And are those people dying every day? The vast majority, 90%, are unvaccinated people who didn't need to die. I mean, that's a hard way to say it, but it's truth. These are all preventable deaths, and yet they go on day after day. And somehow, the 65 million people who are still unvaccinated haven't been convinced that this is something they can do something about.
What has been the policy at the NIH as to vaccination of employees?
Well, we're part of the federal workforce, and so the president's decision that all federal employees, especially those with health responsibilities, which includes us, are mandated to be vaccinated. That's where we are. Our staff have been told, all 23,000 of them, that they must be fully vaccinated by November 22nd, or disciplinary actions will occur. The contractors, and we have a lot of contractors who work with us as well, have been given until December 8th, but the same responsibility will fall on them. This is going to be interesting because while we have, we run a hospital, as you know, the clinical center, and the staff there have very high percentages of vaccination, but amongst other parts of the institution, we're only at about 70%, which surprises me. I would have thought we'd do better than that. Now, some of that is because we just don't know. People have gotten vaccinated in the community. They haven't told us. So now we need to find that out. But I suspect we are going to encounter in the next month examples of people who are just ignoring this and maybe don't believe that this is really serious. It's serious.
And yet, as colder weather approaches, we've heard from several sources that the incidence of COVID may increase because we'll all be inside, as it were.
That's the concern, and especially if people have gotten relaxed about wearing masks indoors. We know that works, despite what you might hear in Texas or Florida. Masks actually do prevent spread of the disease. It's source control. It's mainly about preventing somebody who is unknowingly infected from spreading it to others around them. Although the mask protects you a little bit in terms of being exposed to somebody else, it's mostly this source control. And we know that works. And yet people, perhaps influenced by politicians and social media claims, maybe have kind of lost some of their willingness to stick to that kind of discipline. And that does put us in a higher risk situation as people are moving indoors. And there's still those 65 million unvaccinated people maybe sitting right next to you. We're not in a good place. You know, Diane, I got to say, this is so surprising, frustrating, disheartening that here we are facing the worst pandemic in more than a century. Science called upon in January of 2020 to do the undoable, to come up with ideas that nobody thought of before, to move things at a speed that was thought to be impossible, and came through 11 months later with vaccines that aren't just pretty good. They're probably some of the best we've ever had, 95% effective. And a fantastic safety record with rigorous data behind that, with tens of thousands of people involved in the trials. And I thought at that time, wow, this is gonna get us through this. And now here we are, almost a year later, and we're not through this. And it's not because the science didn't do its job. It's because we didn't understand human behavior well enough to realize that those pockets of resistance against vaccines could spread so dramatically across social media, putting reasonable people in a circumstance of skepticism and fear and misinformation and disinformation, because our whole society has become so susceptible to that. That worries me, not just about what's happening with COVID-19, but about our society in general. So I could even say that we have two epidemics going on right now. One of them is caused by a virus, SARS-CoV-2, and the other is an epidemic of misinformation, disinformation, and a loss of our ability to sift through and figure out what's true. We are at the point now where somebody's opinion is capable of displacing a fact. And somebody's loud claim on social media is capable of pushing aside evidence. What kind of society is that? If we want to have a future, we have to remember our anchor is truth. For me as a Christian, truth will set you free. Those are the words of Jesus. If you take that the other way, what do lies do? They imprison you. Is that where we're going? Lies seem to have a better shot at grabbing people's attention and getting their endorsement than at any time in my lifetime.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Dr. Francis Collins.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
includes the rest of my conversation with Dr. Francis Collins. He'll be stepping down as director of the National Institutes of Health at the end of the year. When you think about the future of this virus, what do you see?
My crystal ball is not as clear as I wish it was, because I've been surprised by this virus already a couple of times. Certainly the emergence of variants, which has been happening with quite a regular series over the course of the last year, has made this a lot more complicated to make any predictions about, and especially the most recent of these, the Delta variant. It's almost like we have a new pandemic with this. It's so much more contagious than what we started with back in early 2020. And it's therefore broken a lot of the rules that we thought we could live by. We thought with a less contagious virus that if we got 70% of the population vaccinated, we might actually be able to see it fade away by herd immunity. When it is this infectious, that rule doesn't apply anymore. And so there's still plenty of vulnerable people around for the virus to keep going. And we don't know whether we've seen the end of these variants. Delta seems to have, as an evolutionary biologist would say, exceptional fitness, fitness for the virus, not for us. But is it the ultimate, or is there something even more fit and therefore even more dangerous that's lurking out there? We're tracking that, as you can imagine, day by day to see if something else popping up somewhere in the world that we should start to worry about.
So does that mean that even now scientists are working on new vaccines for something that they don't even know may be in the future?
If it's some further offspring of this coronavirus, we know exactly what to do if we decide to sort of push the start button, and that is to redesign the vaccine. The elegance of the mRNA approach is that you can do that almost overnight. If you have a virus that emerges whose spike protein is now so different than where we started, that the current vaccines won't provide protection. Fortunately, we're not there yet. The current vaccines work pretty well against even Delta. But if we cross that line into another part of the evolutionary pathway, that the vaccines would no longer seem to be safe, what do? You redesign the vaccine in a big hurry. And that's simply a matter of using a different instruction set of letters for your mRNA, which turns out to be both incredibly effective and incredibly quick in terms of design. There's already been some of that done in anticipation that this might happen, but we haven't had to use it. But if we need to, we're ready to go. And certainly all the vaccine manufacturers are watching this. NIH has a partnership with all of the companies that are working on vaccines and on therapeutics, something called ACTIV, A-C-T-I-V, Accelerating COVID-19 Therapeutic Interventions and Vaccines. That's what it stands for. And a group that looks at this daily is constantly monitoring whether there is some new variant that might look like it could evade protection from vaccines. And if so, when should we push that start button? We're not there yet, but we are certainly watching.
Dr. Collins, how much does it matter whether this virus emerged from one human being or one animal?
Well, we really want to know what happened here. How did this come to pass? Not that it necessarily would change what we're doing right now, but we need to know for the future, how does this kind of a pandemic arise? I think the scientific evidence would say this virus came at some point, probably from a bat, because bats have an incredible variety of these coronaviruses, and the closest relatives to SARS-CoV-2 have been derived from bats. One in a Chinese cave, most recently a bat in Laos, has been found to carry a virus that's the closest yet to SARS-CoV-2. What we don't know is how you get to what we now have, a virus that's spread throughout the world. Did it go directly from bats to humans? that's possible? Was there an intermediate host that we haven't yet discovered where the virus had a chance to incubate and get even more fit for going after humans? We know with SARS, previous coronavirus, there was an intermediate host, the civet cat. It took us 14 years to figure that out. With MERS, the Middle East coronavirus, there was an intermediate host, a camel. That took a while to figure out. It doesn't surprise me that we haven't figured out the intermediate host yet for SARS-CoV-2. That's really hard and it takes time. And maybe there isn't one. Maybe it was so effective that it jumped directly from a bat to a human. Maybe not as such a severe disease to begin with. And then incubated around in some villages somewhere, probably in China, until ultimately it mutated enough to be what is now killing almost 5 million people in the world. We don't know.
Senator Rand Paul and others have accused NIH of funding so-called gain-of-function research. Explain that.
Let's just say Senator Paul has an interest, it seems, in scoring some political points. He hasn't always been that interested in understanding the actual science. We, NIH, as the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world, have felt that it was very much important for us in the advent of SARS and MERS to see what's going on as far as other kinds of coronaviruses that might threaten us. And so we have funded, over the past few years, collaborative research in China to isolate viruses from bats in bat caves and see what's there, and also look to see if in the villages nearby those caves, is there any indication that people are getting sick? So I would argue that that's not just a nice kind of idea. It's almost our obligation to be invested in that. And you could say, well, just let the Chinese do it themselves, but then would we really find out the results? So collaboration is a good thing. This is a modest amount of an investment in a collaboration with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, Senator Paul is trying to argue that the experiments that were being there were somehow connected to the arrival of SARS-CoV-2. That is demonstrably false. The experiments that were done were on naturally occurring bat viruses that are evolutionarily extremely distant from SARS-CoV-2. You can't get to the current pandemic from these natural viruses, which do not infect humans. We were trying to understand what about them might make them eventually capable of infecting humans by doing experiments on those viruses and testing them in mice. And you might get confused, therefore, by this term gain of function, which has been thrown around in a way that I don't think has spread a lot of light on the situation. You know, Diane, gain of function research is something that we do in lots of areas of medicine. Take cancer immunotherapy. What we're doing there is trying to give your immune cells a gain of function so that they will recognize your cancer and go after it. That's good. We want to do that. Somebody who's engineering a bacterium so that it will eat an oil spill. Okay, you're giving the bacteria a gain of function. That's good. The kind of gain of function that needs exquisite oversight is if you're working with a known human pathogen and you are doing experiments that might actually make it worse, more transmissible, more virulent. That kind of experiment requires, according to the federal government and the effort that was figured out several years ago, exquisite oversight. What was going on at the Wuhan Institute does not meet that definition. These were bat viruses not capable of infecting humans. We were trying to learn from them. So when Senator Paul tries to say you were doing gain-of-function research in the exquisite detailed definition used for government oversight, no. In the common use of the term gain of function, well, it gets confusing. So the terminology has not helped us here. But I do wish Senator Paul would take a little time to understand those details, because then I think it would be fairly clear that his accusations that Dr. Fauci is not telling the truth would be seen for what they are, basically trumped up political accusations with no substance.
And considering that trumped-up accusations are fast and furious, as they have been through the last 22 months, what is your thinking about how that might affect funding for the NIH?
Well, I have to worry about that. You know, Diane, for my 12 years as NIH director, and before that, another 15 years leading the Genome Institute at NIH, one of the wonderful things about medical research in this town with all of its fracturing is that medical research seemed to remain above the fray. It was truly a bipartisan or nonpartisan issue. Everybody cared about finding answers for terrible diseases, for cancer, for Alzheimer's, for diabetes, for rare diseases, common diseases. That was such a compelling argument. And NIH has this incredible track record of having made contributions to that that have been stunning over the decades. And so we generally could kind of rise above that. I must have met with hundreds of members of Congress one-on-one in my time at NIH, and it almost didn't matter which party I was talking to or which house. It always went well because I had something to bring to the table that everybody could agree, this is worth doing. So it does trouble me that now in the face of COVID-19, where NIH and the whole scientific community has risen to this challenge in amazing ways, and people have worked 24/7 beyond what most of us thought we could do, and yet somehow there are still forces out there that are trying to turn some of this into a conspiracy that is mean-spirited. It is not aiming in any way to try to find the truth. It is maybe simply trying to deflect the blame for other parts of the government that have handled this pandemic poorly. And that's disgraceful, and it's hurtful, and it does make me worry about the way in which that spills over into general impressions about NIH and the value of research. And it becomes maybe also a little part of what feels like more of an anti-science sentiment in the country than is good for it, and maybe more than has been there in the previous years, just at the point where science has the most to offer to get us through this.
One further question on research and the growth in numbers of those afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. How much are we learning, gaining, moving toward some kind of medication to treat Alzheimer's? The one that has been approved by the FDA is so controversial. And one member of the FDA resigned over the approval thereof. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, Alzheimer's is the highest possible priority for figuring out answers when you consider the terrible toll this is taking on people and on their families. It's a very hard problem, or we would have had it figured out by now. Congress has increased NIH's ability to invest in this fivefold in the course of the last 7 or 8 years, the most dramatic uptick in any area of research spending.
So total spending is what?
I think it must be about $2.6 billion a year, close to that, and it used to be about $500 million. So, yeah, enormous increase there. And that's drawn a lot of new investigators into the field, especially early stage investigators who are like young and full of ideas and ready to see what they can do. We have an awful lot of exciting leads, but we don't necessarily have something that's on the brink of being the answer. And obviously, everybody's trying to figure out what to make of aducanumab, otherwise known as Aduhelm, this monoclonal antibody from Biogen, which in at least one of the two trials where it was tested may have improved people's performance who were early in the first symptoms of Alzheimer's. There's no question that it reduced the amount of amyloid in their brain. Everybody agrees the drug works on that as a biomarker, but does the biomarker actually predict improved performance? That's where the question is. I think we need to get a good answer to that. and certainly additional trials. And there are other drugs in this class coming forward from other companies like Lilly. So we're going to get that figured out, but we should not assume that that's going to be the best solution. And so, again, working with industry and something called the Accelerating Medicines Partnership that I've thrown myself into heart and soul for the last 7 years, we have at least 50 other pathways for Alzheimer's therapeutics that look pretty interesting and pretty approachable. And all of those have got to be pushed until we get something that really works.
I have a question. We've been talking about the future, and I'm wondering about yours. What are you planning to do with or for yourself and your wife?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out too. I am planning to return to my laboratory at a much larger time commitment than I've been able to do. But Diane, I've been running a research lab at NIH since 1993, when I arrived. I have about 10 remarkably gifted scientists who are toiling there right now in two projects. One is to try to understand the hereditary factors in adult onset diabetes and how those could lead us towards new ideas about prevention and treatment. And that is going extremely well with all of the things we can do now with new technologies. And the other is a very rare disease that causes premature aging called progeria. Affected individuals, kids, age at about 7 times the normal rate and die at about age 12 or 13 of heart attacks and strokes. We discovered the cause. We already have gotten a drug approved by FDA for treatment that extends life, but it's not a cure. And now we're on the trail of how to do something much more dramatic using the CRISPR gene editing approach. And at least in our mouse model, this is looking fantastically promising, and I hope we'll be in a human clinical trial within a year or so. So I'm excited about that. And the people in the lab who are used to sort of dealing with me by emails and Zoom calls are going to find I'm in their midst, and I hope they like that. They don't say, oh, maybe you want to go do something else.
But now, what about personally? Will you have a bit more free time?
I'm counting on that because I have been working 100 hours a week for the last 22 months and pretty close to that before that. And yeah, Diane and I are really looking forward to having more flexibility to be able
Diane.
My wife, yes, right. I should have clarified that. My wife, Diane Baker, spend more time with our 5 grandchildren, my 2 wonderful daughters. I'm interested in doing some more writing. That book I wrote 15 years ago, The Language of God, is about ready for a new edition. And maybe that's something I could work on. And I just like the time to have to think and read and contemplate, what am I supposed to do when I grow up? What's the next calling? What's out there? I'm not ready to sit in the lounge chair or spend my days playing golf. I'm sure people do and enjoy that, but I don't think that's me, at least not quite yet.
And will you have any role in deciding who the next director might be?
Nothing formal, although I would not be upset if somebody asked my opinion. And the president already indicated he might be interested in hearing my opinion when he called me very graciously on October 5th at the time of my announcement and said, yes, he wants to get somebody really fantastic. And I said, I think you should get somebody really fantastic. This is the best job in biomedical research. And by the way, I hope you'll go after a woman because it would be great to have an NIH director who's a woman. We've only had one, Bernadine Healy, who recruited me to come to NIH.
I remember Dr. Healy well. I spoke with her several times. Well, Dr. Collins, I, for one, am certainly going to miss you, miss talking with you as director of the NIH. But when something new happens in your own laboratory or when your new book comes out, I hope I'll be there and you'll be there and we'll talk again.
I would love that. Let's make a deal right now that that will be what happens when there's something exciting to say.
Thank you so much for being with us and good luck to you.
Thanks, Diane. And same to you. It's great to spend a little time with you.
That was Dr. Francis Collins. He served as director of the National Institutes of Health for 12 years. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruttenberg and Ben Landsverka of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.